Good afternoon and welcome to the 414th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting is coming to you from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 to promote study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 35th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign relations. Details about past and upcoming forum events are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. For our meeting today, we are very pleased to have a former colleague of mine at the National Security Council, Ambassador Michael McFaul, speaking to us about Russia, a subject on which he's an unparalleled expert. Ambassador Michael McFaul is Professor of Political Science at Stanford University, Director and Senior Fellow at Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, and the Peter and Helen Bing Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He joined the Stanford faculty in 1995. He is also an analyst for NBC News and a contributing columnist to the Washington Post. Dr. McFaul served for 5 years in the Obama administration, first from 2009 to 2012 as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russian and Eurasian Affairs at the National Security Council, and then from 2012 to 2014 as Ambassador, U.S. Ambassador to the Russian Federation. He's the author of, I think, more than a dozen books, and I won't list them all here, but his most recent book is entitled From Cold War to Hot Peace. It was published in May and by August had reached the New York Times bestseller list. The book is the story of his experience as U.S. ambassador to Russia and his uneasy relationship with Russian President Putin. Ambassador McFaul's current research interests include American foreign policy, great powers relations, and the relationship between democracy and development. Dr. McFaul received his bachelor's in international relations and Slavic languages and master's in Soviet and Eastern European studies from Stanford University. He was a Rhodes Scholar, completing his PhD in international relations at Oxford University in 1991. Mike, I want to issue a warm welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thank you all. Thank you, George and Karen, for having me here. I can't believe there's this many people on a beautiful day. Have we been outside? I just want to say one word about George, though. I'd never worked in the government until I showed up January 21st, 2009. There's a lot we could say about government work. But one of the great things about serving in the government was everything that George represented. One, a commitment to the American national interest. I always felt like when I was talking to George, we were not talking about Democratic interest or Republican interest. We were always talking about the national interest. Number two, the idea that we're here to do things. That's hard to do, actually, in the government. Mostly, you just be things. But we were committed to doing some things. Next. But then third, George, you were just a great colleague to me. One thing I learned in the government was information is key. And I sat around in some of these missile defense meetings for a while, and then the New START Treaty, and I realized if I didn't get smart on things like telemetry, anybody know what telemetry is? SM3 Block 2B. I could go through a lot of different acronyms that I kind of remember from graduate school, but George helped me to learn those things. You were kind of, you were like a little tutor, not a little tutor, an important tutor to me that allowed me to be part of the policy process. Not everybody was that generous, George. A lot of people hoarded their information precisely to keep people like me quiet. In fact, we took a trip, I don't know if you remember, in January in 2010 to Moscow, and when I was talking a little too much for some people from the Pentagon, I was told, your job is to sit, not to speak. But George never ever said that to me, and I'm really grateful to you for doing that. And the last great thing about being in the government, but especially my years at the NSC with George, was just being on the team. I love being on the team. In fact, when I was sworn in 2012, I talked about teamers. This was a word my son Cole used to use when he was in second grade. He said, when do I go get to see my teamers, my basketball teamers? And what was great about being in the government was having great teamers like George. So thank you for having me here. I'm going to give you the argument of the book, and I'm going to bounce around from kind of anecdotes to professor. I'm going to do that for about 25 minutes, and then I just want to take your questions on anything and everything. I'm going to try to not say the word Trump for at least 25 minutes. So if you're here to listen about Trump, you need to ask your questions about that, because I actually want to tell the bigger story of how we got to our relationship where it is with Russia today. And then we'll end in Trump if we have time, okay? I see enough gray hair in this room that I don't have to explain what the Cold War was. At Stanford, I have to lecture on what was the Cold War, because 18-year-olds don't know what the Cold War was, but I'm not going to do that with you. You remember the Cold War. The Cold War was a big, important event for me. I was worried that we were going to go to war with the Soviets growing up as a kid in Bozeman, Montana. You know, most people went to Paris or London, or my wife, then girlfriend, went to Florence, Italy to study abroad. On my first trip abroad, after a couple years at Stanford, when I was animated by the idea that if we could just understand the Russians better, we could reduce misunderstandings and tensions in our bilateral relationship back then. Remember, Ronald Reagan's president, he called this place the evil empire, and I was going to the evil empire for my first trip abroad. By the way, imagine that conversation with my mother. My mother thought California was a communist country. She'd never been. She was horrified that I wanted to go to school there, and when I came back with long hair and kind of communist ideas, she's like, I knew they were communists there. And so imagine when I said, hey, Mom, I'm going to the evil empire for the summer. Bless her heart, she supported me to this day. All right, so I just want to remind you, and the book talks about my own intellectual history, that that's why I got involved. And so when the Cold War ended, for me, the ending of the Cold War was a fantastic event. I don't want to have any qualification. It was a fantastic event for our country, for the Russians, for the maybe not for the Soviets, all of them, everybody. But to me, you know, that was the end of history. That when we were all going to become liberal democracies. And real people drove that story, right? Reagan did. Gorbachev did. And so, you know, and I just want to remind you, this was a pretty good time in terms of U.S.-Russian relations. We had a close relationship, and we thought we were going to go down that road because of those events. Today, however, is the opposite or different. Whether it's the opposite or not, we can talk about in questions. But Dmitry Medvedev, 2 years ago, the prime minister, he said it feels like 1962, right? That's the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So not like 1991 or 1992. And our own president, of course, on Twitter, said it's worse than the Cold War, our current period today, in terms of our confrontation. And again, I don't want to spend too much time on the semantics about the differences between the Cold War and what I call the hot peace. There are some things that are similar. There are some things that are different. Just to give a few examples, the number of quantitative nuclear weapons have gone down rapidly. That's the good news. But the number of qualitative nuclear weapons are on the increase, especially what the Russians are doing. Are we better off or worse off? I don't know. Where I live on the coast in the South Bay, in the Bay. Russia has just, Mr. Putin has just announced a new weapon, a torpedo. We knew about a long time ago, remember, George? He declassified that information for us all. And that weapon is aimed at us. And it's aimed at killing a lot of people in the Bay Area, by the way. And by the way, it's also not controlled by it's not controlled by the START Treaty because it doesn't go through the air. We better or worse off? I don't know. On the ideological dimension, the good news, communism versus capitalism is over. That's over. You know, maybe in Berkeley they're still fighting about it, but most of the world, maybe in Cuba, I don't know, I haven't been there. Most of the world, that ideological struggle is over. But there's a new ideological struggle. At least Putin thinks there is. He is propagating a set of ideas that he would describe as conservative, anti-liberal, anti-multinational, and he invests hundreds of billions of dollars to propagate those ideas over the last decade. And he's winning ideological allies around the world, in Hungary, in Italy, in the United States of America. That's new. That ideological struggle is a different dimension than the Cold War. Are we better off or worse off? I'm not sure if we're better off today. And then the last one, just we'll come back to this in questions if you're interested. But the last one, the means of fighting this Cold War, the hot peace, have also changed when compared with the Cold War. So annexation, that didn't happen during the Cold War. We thought we were done with annexation. 2014, Putin annexed Crimea, a new instrument of our confrontation. Sanctions, even during the heyday, the height of 1962, there were no Americans or Soviets on long sanctions list. Today, there are hundreds of Russians on our sanctions list, and there are at least dozens of Americans on the Russian sanctions list. I know, because I'm one of them. I can't travel to Russia right now as a result of that. And then just some really nasty things. There were assassination attempts from time to time during the Cold War abroad, but using chemical weapons to assassinate people in the United Kingdom, that's a new means of fighting between Russia and the West. So you tell me whether we're better off or not, but I think we'd all agree we're definitely not where we thought we were going to be at the end of the Cold War. And part of this is true. I want to be clear. Part of this story is true. Power does matter in the international system. Anybody from Moldova? Not if you've been to Moldova. Nobody's from Moldova, right? And actually, that came out wrong. I love Moldova. I actually went there with the vice president in 2011. Vice President Biden, 50,000 people came out to listen to him talk on the square. I'm not sure 50,000 people have ever come out for a speech for the vice president before. He loved it. It became his favorite country as well. Point is, I'm not here to talk about U.S.-Moldovan relations, and you don't want to hear me talk about U.S.-Moldovan relations because Moldova does not have the power to annex territory, support President Assad in Syria, or violate our sovereignty in the 2016 elections. They don't have that capacity, right? Russia has that power. So power matters. But it's not the whole story for today, two reasons. One, I can think of some countries that rise in power and don't become our enemies and don't threaten their neighbors. Japan, Germany, Italy, even Poland today, a lot more power capability than they had 30 years ago, and yet we're not worried about them redrawing borders, even though they have claims to territory. At least they think they do. But number two, and this is more important to me, when I was ambassador, the number one goal for Vladimir Putin was to create something called the Eurasian Economic Union. I'm sure most of you never heard of it, because our press didn't really cover it. We wrote lots of cables that I don't think anybody read, talking about how important this was. You know, about once a week we reported on the Eurasian Economic Union. And it was a simple idea, to bring together all the former states of the Soviet Union, the republics, and put them in one economic group as a counterweight to the European Union. That's what he was focused on. And he had Belarus signed up. He had Kazakhstan signed up, and when I was ambassador, he was focused on getting Ukraine to join. That was his number one foreign policy objective, get the Ukrainians to join the Eurasian Economic Union. And here's why, and this is my last question. I'm sorry, I'm a professor, so usually I'm fighting with computers. I don't see anybody checking their email. So I ask a lot of questions. So anybody buys something, now listen closely, made in Russia, but you didn't buy it on your vacation to Russia. You bought it here in Maine. Anything made in Russia? Have you ever bought anything? Anybody? Nothing. Vodka? You bought vodka? Seriously? You bought it here in Maine? Okay, vodka, that usually comes up. That's one. Anybody else? Made in Russia. Interesting. Oh, yeah, sir, what'd you buy? Diamonds. Tell me more. Or maybe you don't want to. That came from Russia, and they're sold here in the United States. Okay, interesting. They are one of the largest producers. I didn't know they sold them here. All right, diamonds, that's one. Yes, sir. Caviar? Are you sure that was legal? I'm kidding. A lot of their caviar has become illegal these days. Okay, nesting dolls, okay, that usually comes up. So that was in some store you bought. They make nesting dolls. They have diamonds, oil and gas. You don't usually buy that. These are some of the things they do, but they don't. You know, my suit's made in Vietnam. You don't find many made in Russia goods that are bought here in the United States, nor in most of Europe. There's one country that buys a lot of made in Russia goods. It's Ukraine. 45 million of them, at least before. And so it was imperative to get them to join to make this thing hum. And during, 2014, Putin annexes Crimea, I think guaranteeing forever that Ukraine will never join. So something must have changed along the way between 2012 and 2014. Something more proximate, right? It's not, power is part of the explanation, but not the whole explanation. All right, second argument. America, it's all our fault. This also is popular in Moscow and Berkeley and, maybe here, I don't know. It actually is a theory and an argument in academia that this was all of our making because of our imperial ways. Here's the shorthand version. The longhand version, of course, is in the book. Russia was weak. We then told them they had to build markets. We then expanded NATO. We then bombed Serbia in 1999. We then invaded Iraq in 2003. We then supported color revolutions in Serbia 2000, Georgia 2003, Ukraine in 2004. And Putin just finally said, enough is enough. We have to push back on American imperial aggression that is not in our interest. And again, like that first argument, all of these things happened, and all of these events do represent tension in U.S.-Russian relations. That's true. And I go through it in detail in the book. And yet, after all these things happened, there was a period of cooperation when some of us were in the government together. We called it the reset, for better or for ill. And I think the argument, I was part of making the argument, so I think it was a good argument, was, rather than getting too hung up on the Cold War or, historical legacies, let's just rationally kind of think about what's in our interests and then present that scope of things that we think would be in Russia's interests. And most certainly that was the president's idea. And then look for what he likes to call win-win outcomes in U.S.-Russian relations. And that's what we did for about 3 or 4 years. When I was working at the White House, too. That was our strategy towards Russia. It wasn't that complicated. There it is. And I'm going to go through, I've talked a long time already. I'm going to go through this list quickly. So all of this I have a chapter on all these. But we did do some things. Do things, right? Action verb during the years of the reset. We developed this thing called NDN. I was in charge of this at the White House. When we came in, 95% of our supplies went through Pakistan. We were totally dependent on Pakistan for our supplies for our troops in Afghanistan, right? Our idea was, let's reduce that because we had planned to take the war against terror into Pakistan from time to time. You maybe remember very famously in 2011, the day we killed Osama bin Laden. In order to do that, we had to reduce our dependency on Pakistan. And over time, with Russians' cooperation, we developed this incredibly elaborate transportation system through Russia, through Central Asia, to reduce our dependency on Pakistan. Couldn't have done that without the Russians. We got sanctions on Iran, the most comprehensive sanctions ever, 2010. Couldn't have done that without the Russians. And then I like to remind, maybe in this room I don't have to, but I'd like to remind people about non-events. People don't write books about non-events, but I think they're important in terms of understanding history. Without question, the scariest several weeks of my time working at the White House was during the so-called Kyrgyz color revolution of 2010. The leader there was overthrown, 100 people died, 300,000 ethnic Uzbeks that lived in Kyrgyzstan moved into Uzbekistan because they were worried about being slaughtered by ethnic Kyrgyz. And we thought we were on the verge of an ethnic war, a genocidal war, and maybe even an interstate war between Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. And you may think, well, who cares about Kyrgyzstan? Well, we cared about Kyrgyzstan a lot. Because back then, we ran something called the Manas Air Base out of Kyrgyzstan, where over 95% of our troops pre-positioned in before they went to Afghanistan. The fuel for the war in Afghanistan all came from Manas Air Base. But you didn't read about the conflict between Russia and the United States that ruined the reset over the color revolution in Kyrgyzstan, because before it got to that, we diffused the crisis because we were in this cooperative spirit. So we were moving in the right direction in terms of economic relations as well. And at the peak of all this, most Russians, 60%, had a positive view of Americans, and the same was true of most Americans thinking about Russia. That's just 5-6 years ago. So, to come back to the argument, you cannot blame NATO expansion, color revolutions, the Iraq war for our current conflict without having a story for how to explain that cooperative period I just talked about. At least you can't do that in my class. That's a C minus in my class. You have to have an explanation for both cooperation and conflict. And just citing these things, all that cooperation I just talked about came after these things. So we have to add something more to the equation. And that gets to my third and last argument about Russian domestic politics. And here, let me just focus. It's a more complex story, which is why you should get the book. But here's the simplified version. Two big things happened. One, Putin came back as president. And two, popular demonstrations took place against his regime. Let me walk you through that, and then I'm going to jump to questions. All right, first, September 2011, Putin announces he's going to run for president again for the March 2012 elections. And here he is announcing it rather emphatically at his party Congress. And Medvedev agrees to serve as prime minister. And, you know, I remember this very vividly that day. I was still waiting to be confirmed as ambassador. Even thought about maybe we shouldn't go because Putin's going to be there. I had a good relationship with Medvedev. Putin and I are not Facebook friends. I was actually in to see the president about something else. And at the end of the meeting, he pulled my arm back. He grabbed my shoulder and he just pulled me back into the oval. He said, "Well, Mike, what do you think? What do you think this is going to mean?" And initially, I kind of gave him the party line, the intel line, the IC community assessment, which is that Putin's always been the big dog. He's always been the big decision maker. Why should this change anything? He's just going to change offices, but he's always been in charge. And Obama looked at me and he said, "Come on, man. You don't really believe that." And I said, "No, Mr. President, I don't believe that. I think it's going to be the end of our cooperation with these guys because Putin has a very different worldview than Medvedev. That's not what most people thought. Everybody just thought of Medvedev as the marionette doing Putin's bidding. I had a different view. I'd known Putin since the spring of 1991, by the way. It was not, meeting him was not the first time when I joined the government. And we learned about this different worldview. One, he sees the world in zero-sum terms, not win-win. When Medvedev signed the New START Treaty, he said in English, "Barak, this is a win-win." And he said it in English, because Obama used to love to use that phrase, for the United States and of America. Putin doesn't see a lot of win-wins. Generally speaking, he's a zero-sum kind of guy. Plus two for America, that's minus two for Russia. But especially with us, he sees that with all countries in the world mostly, especially with us, we're a competitor on a good day, we're an enemy on a bad day, and he has a lot of bad days about us, okay? And then the third thing, and we learned this over time as we had more and more meetings with him. The third one is really the crux of the matter that led to the end of cooperation. He believes that the United States uses overt and covert power to overthrow regimes around the world that we don't like. And guess what? There's a lot of empirical data to support that hypothesis about American foreign policy over the last 70 years, right? There is. I teach a whole course on it. And so our mission, as Obama came in and started dealing with them, in fact, it really crystallized in this meeting in July 2009. Whoops. Obama tried to convince him that we were out of that business. By the way, Putin came loaded for bear in this meeting. He had a lot he wanted to say about how horrible the Bush administration was. He spoke for about 58 minutes about that without interruption. Obama's a lot more patient guy than I am. He went on this incredible tirade about all the mistakes they made, never criticizing President Bush, by the way. He was off to the side. It was the deep state. It was, you know, the CIA, the Pentagon, Dick Cheney. He definitely has that deep state mentality about how things work. Presidents come and go. The deep state rules things. Anyway, we got to Iraq, and he went on. He had a nice speech, thought through about how horrible that war was. And my guy, you know, President Obama, he turned to him and he said, "You're right. I agree. That was a huge mistake." And Putin's kind of twisting like this. He's like, "Hey, wait a minute. I'm playing the Russians here. You're playing the Americans." He had never heard an American ever say that. Think about who he'd been dealing with since 2003. He'd never heard an American say that. And Obama said, "Yeah, way before it was popular to be against that war, I'm against that war, and we are not doing regime change. This is a new era. Change you believe in." Remember he used to say that? We are not going to be in that business. As we walked out to our cars, I could tell Putin was like looking at him like, maybe this guy is different, right? Maybe he looks different, he talks different, he's younger. And it was like, you know, go work with Medvedev. Like, I'm done dealing with you Americans. Been there, done that. I've been burned before. But maybe this is going to work out. And 18 months later, in Putin's view, his hypothesis about America was confirmed. And Obama was no different from anybody else. Started in Tunisia. It got serious for us in Egypt, of course. Then Libya. And Libya really was a turning point in U.S.-Russian relations. We did not generate any of these demonstrations. I want to be clear about that. Sometimes people think that we were behind these. We were not. We were reacting to small D Democrats in all these countries trying to take charge of their lives and their country. We were reacting just like everybody else. But when it got to Libya, we were scared to death that Gaddafi was going to slaughter hundreds of thousands of people in a city of Benghazi. And so we thought we had to stop that. And we went to the Russians because Obama's a multilateral guy, right? He wants a UN Security Council resolution to do this. We weren't going to do it unilaterally. And I was on that trip with Biden. We were actually in the Kremlin when Medvedev said, "You guys are right. We have to stop this." And the Russians, for the first time ever, before or since, they've never done it before, again, abstained on a Security Council resolution to allow the use of force in Libya. And that Medvedev knew that that's what he was authorizing to do because he agreed with us about our theory about what was going on here. 2 days later, after that vote, Putin criticized him publicly. And I think that was the end of Medvedev. He basically saying this: the Medvedev is drunk. He's drinking too much of this reset Kool-Aid. He's wrong about the Americans. The Americans are messianic missionaries here, and there's no difference between Libya in 2011 and Iraq 2003 in his view. And these events, I think, confirm for him that we were the enemy. Then Syria, obviously, was a horrible fight we had about with the Russians. But then it's punctuated at the end of the year in Russia itself. Falsified election, kind of normal standard rates, 5 to 7%. But this time, tens, then 50, then hundreds, thousands, and then at the peak of it, 200,000 people came out to protest this falsified parliamentary vote. And when you get that many people together, they get stirred up. They go from, "Let's have a better parliamentary election," to, "Hey, why don't we throw out Putin?" And that's with some of the slogans that these guys were chanting at the time. And remember, the last time you had that many people on the streets of Moscow, I already told you about it, was 1991, the year that there was regime change in the Soviet Union, the year that the Soviet Union collapsed, an event that Putin calls one of the greatest tragedies of the 20th century. So for Putin, well, first he was just pissed at these people for protesting, like, "I made you rich, why are you turning against me?" But then he was scared. Just, you know, this was the year of the Arab Spring, people falling all over the Middle East, and that's when he developed this new argument about us. These protesters were our puppets. They were our agents, America, Obama, and me, ultimately. I arrive in Moscow literally 2 weeks after that first demonstration. And that becomes his new argument to his people that we are out to get them again. We are out to do to Russia what we did to Iraq, what we did to Libya, what we did in those other color revolutions. That was the story that begins in January 2012. It actually begins before. I like to point that out. Slightly before I arrive in January 2012. But by the time I get there, I become the focal point of this argument, that I was sent by Barack Obama to foment revolution against the Putin regime. In fact, even the day before I went to the embassy for my first day of work, they ran a 20-minute hit piece on me saying that's what I was sent to do. And by the way, you know, you've heard of disinformation. Well, I dealt with this disinformation every single day. And they don't care about taking out the word "not," for instance, from time to time in your articles, talking about how I was sent to do this. And I literally became the poster child for this kind of argument. And then the last straw, and I'll just end on this. Same theme, right? Protesters out on the streets threatening people that Putin supports. We didn't actually give these people money and tell them to overthrow, but this is now Ukraine in the fall of 2013. We thought we got a deal done, a negotiation in February 2014 between President Yanukovych and the leadership of these protests. I remember it. I was in Sochi, and it was I was with Secretary Burns, and we thought we had dodged a bullet here. But 14 hours later, Yanukovych shows up in Rostov. We don't know why he left, by the way. To this day, I don't know why he left. But for Putin, here it is again. Same old story. CIA overthrowing somebody, this time who's my ally and this time who's on my border. And that's when he decided, I've had enough of cooperation with these guys. I'm going to strike back. That's when he takes Crimea. And when it's cheap, that's when he starts to support the separatists in eastern Ukraine. And then later, of course, as you know this story, so I won't go over it, he goes on the offense vis-a-vis the United States. I'm now going to push back in their home court in the way that he alleges we did before. So I'll end on this. The good news is if you believe my story, we are not destined to be in conflict with Russia because of their history or their culture or the balance of power in the international system. I don't believe that. This is about individuals taking decisions to move us this way. In the same way that Reagan and Gorbachev moved us to a more cooperative place, Putin, because of the reasons I just described, has moved us in this other way. The bad news is that Putin's not changing his mind. He's set in his ways. He just was reelected, and he works out 2 to 3 hours a day. So I don't see a way to change that. We can talk about this guy in questions. I'll leave that just lingering for you. This, at the end of the day, Putin needs us as an enemy in order to maintain his power. But to understand the real story in all its complexity, we will end right here. All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I always take the prerogative of the person who's moderating to ask the first question. And you really didn't get a chance to talk very much about Trump's policy toward Russia.
Yeah.
I've always been confused on whether there is a Trump-Russian policy, and if so, what it is. Could you kind of give me your views on
that? I was running out of time there, so I skipped Trump. There are two, George, there's not one, there's two Trump policies. It's great. They have two Trump policies towards Russia. And they really do. I believe that. That the president himself has one approach. And, you know, I would describe it as he's got a kind of great man theory, right? He thinks himself as being a great man, and therefore he can engage with other great leaders in the world. He tends to like the autocrats more than the Democrats out there in the world. But he just thinks, if I can just bond with Putin, we can get along. And he says that all the time. You don't have to believe me. He says it all the time. The problem with that, I'm not against engagement, by the way. I want to be clear about that. I believe engagement even with regimes that we don't like, even with regimes that we disagree with. We did that during the Cold War, after all. But the problem is the president never defines what he's seeking to achieve that's good for America as a result of that engagement. He defines engagement, the good meeting, as he did in Helsinki, that's the objective. We had a nice chat. Okay, well, what did we get out of that? Like, how does that make us more secure? How does that make us more so prosperous? His job as a president is to advance our interests, not just for him to have nice teas and nice pieces of chocolate cake, as he did with President Xi, right? And he just doesn't understand that. I honestly believe I have good friends that work for him and worked for him. He's a lot of people have already left. General McMaster's first day of work at Stanford starts today, by the way, one of them. He just doesn't get that. The rest of the administration, you know, there's still arguments in the interagency process. They do understand that. And I would say that on balance, they believe that there's not a lot that can be done in terms of the U.S.-Russian relationship. So he is at odds with almost his entire administration, with a couple of exceptions. And one of the hopes that I have, I talk about, you know, just focus on things you can do that require Russia to be a part of it. And one of them, George, is to extend the New START treaty. That I, when I get the chance to talk to the Trump people, I say, just do one thing. Don't try to reset relations. Don't try to end this confrontation. That's too hard. It's not going to happen. Just do one thing before you leave. Extend the New START treaty. And then you can say that you did something in U.S.-Russian relations.
I guess here's one that I think follows up kind of on what you were just talking about. That is, will Trump undo all of the reset results? What will replace them?
Well, the dirty little secret that you now know of, that I like to joke about with my friends in the government, remember who signed the New START treaty. So nobody, please don't tell Donald Trump that Obama signed the New START treaty, because that'll make him against it. I mean, generally speaking, he is unwinding a lot of things that I think were accomplishments. I mean, the sanctions that we did in 2010, that was a permissive condition, a necessary condition to get the Iran nuclear deal done. And I think that was it wasn't everything that we wanted, but better than the alternative. And he's walking away from that. I think that's a mistake. Paris is the same thing. I think that's a mistake. Even the agenda about multilateralism and trade, you know, thankfully he can't do it all in one decree, but I think he's doing a lot of damage to that. And those are things that President Obama worked on. The good news is we do have veto players. So we have the rest of the government. I mean, I don't need to tell you, we political people would come and go, right? You would see us come in, we'd go out. You guys would be there, George, right? And the professionals would move things in the right direction, especially when it's not on the president's radar, right? So like development assistance right now, which I'm quite confident in saying from what I've heard that Trump doesn't believe in at all. He literally thinks we should never do it, but it's not on his radar, so he's not going after it, thankfully, and that other people in the government and the U.S. Congress are working to kind of keep it off to the side. And that dynamic, that's happening with trade as well. I mean, you know, that's one factor. Number two, there are multilateral institutions that play a role. And then there are three, other countries get a veto. And what we're seeing with the Chinese, we can't dictate to the Chinese what we want them to do. And I hope the president learns that lesson.
One here on Russian, just the Russian system working. Discuss the issue of patronage as a key source of power for Russian leadership and its impact on U.S.-Russian relations.
So that's a great question. You know, at Stanford, we usually get 70 minutes to do our lectures. And I have a whole lecture on that. But let me give you the Twitter version. So, it's command economy, move to capitalism. There's plans for privatization in the 1990s. And the long and the short of it is, the way that land and property and enterprises were privatized were not done, in my view, in a legitimate way that locked in their authority. And then add that to a very weak judiciary system. So as a result of that, when Putin comes into power in 2000, he starts to redistribute that property, and there's no pushback. There's no pushback from the courts. There's pushback from the people that own it from time to time, but they don't have a court to say, hey, he just took my oil company. And they said, well, who gave you that oil company? Yeltsin gave it to me. Well, on what authority? I'm thinking of Mr. Khodorkovsky, for instance, who at the time owned Yukos, the largest oil company in Russia. On what authority did he give it to you? And then he's got to like backtrack, right? Well, you know, there was this loans for shares thing, and we helped him win in 1996. It doesn't have legitimacy in society. So what that means, a lot of redistribution. Putin's number one right-hand man, when I first met him in the spring of 1991, I was working for NDI, the National Democratic Institute, on a democracy promotion thing. Think about that, interacting with Putin. He was the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg. And he could tell right away this was not his cup of tea. So he said, but my good friend Iger here, he'll take care of you. And Iger did. He arranged the seminars. Later, his name's Iger Sechin. He now owns or controls the largest oil company in Russia. But the minute Putin goes, the next people are going to come and say, well, Iger, how did you become the CEO of Rosneft? And he's going to say, well, I worked hard and I grew the share market cap and blah, blah. No. You got it because of your 30-year relationship with Putin. That's going to be illegitimate today. And that is the paradox of the current system today. I actually think Putin would love to retire. He seems kind of annoyed when you're in meetings with him, like he doesn't really want to be there. But he can't because of this patronage system, because if he leaves, all the people around him, their property rights are in danger, and so they're the ones that are pushing him to stay in power.
I guess one of the questions here is whether you think that Putin is going to step aside in 2024 or whatever, or is he going to figure out some way to change the Constitution again or put in a surrogate for another whatever? I mean, is Putin going to give up power ever?
Well, one of the things I learned in government, you hear about the intelligence community and all this secret information, and it turns out they're not very good at predicting regime change, just like we in political science aren't. I actually don't think he'll step down. I don't, partly for the way I just answered the last question. I think it'll be too hard for him because of that group around him. When you've been president forever, you look out at your lieutenants and you don't see anybody that's your equivalent. You know, this was Stalin used to talk about this. Who could ever replace me? You know, you guys are so inferior to me. And there's a bit of that with Putin today. He doesn't listen to anybody because he doesn't feel like he has any peers, either domestically or foreign leaders. So I will be surprised. I mean, they're working on it. I know the plan for him to step down. And if he does, he'll choose somebody that's loyal to him, that he hopes to carry out Putinism forevermore, right? But if we push the prediction out to a comfortable place where you'll never remember or not whether I said this, say 20 years out, then I think things get more interesting because this system is not performing as well as it used to. You know, growth is at 1.5-2%. Putin's ratings are down considerably from where they were after he invaded Ukraine. We all rally around the flag. All countries do. Russia did for their war. And that war, by the way, is against NATO and Nazis. It was not against Ukrainians. So that he got that bump. It's fading. And here's what the thought I would leave you with. I'll give you one anecdote and one from academia. So in academia, we have a theory. It's called modernization theory that says the more well-to-do a society is, the more likely they are to demand democracy. Rule of law. If you think about that, people get richer, they own things, they don't want, you know, guys just coming in and taking it away from them, right? And that's a theory, it's been around for a long time. And if you look at over 300 years, China's challenging it, right? China's the big outlier, but China's nowhere near GDP per capita, nowhere near as rich as the threshold when countries normally make this transition. And you leave the oil exporters out, 18 of the 20 richest countries in the world are democracies. The only ones on the list are Singapore and Hong Kong, and Hong Kong's really not a country itself, right? So that's a pretty robust argument. And Russia is one of those really rich countries in the world, Russia and Kazakhstan, that should be towards that threshold. That's the first data point. By the way, Russia has oil that helps them stay in power. It's called the oil curse. If you don't need to tax people to stay in power, that gives you an alternative way to stay in power without asking for your permission to tax you, right? That there's a relationship between that with the oil exporters. They have more; they're more insulated from domestic pressure. But here's the other thing. 1952. Imagine you dropped into Moscow in 1952. Everybody in 1952 assumed that Stalinism was going to last forever. The year 1953 dies. 3 years later, Khrushchev gives his famous de-Stalinization speech. And for a decade, they were moving in a de-Stalinization period. 1983, the year I showed up in Leningrad, it was considered, zastoy is what they call it, stagnation. Nobody was excited about the regime, but everybody said the regime was stable. And by the way, so did we. All of our experts said it's stable. It's lagging, but it's stable. Literally 3 years later, Gorbachev comes to power. 8 years later, the country doesn't even exist. So when lots, and I'm not going to name them, but some of our colleagues, when they say, well, Putinism is here to stay, I always say, well, you know, remember those periods of change.
Obviously, a lot of the success of, early success of the reset was due to Medvedev. Is he still a player now, and couldn't he help repair some of the problems that we're having?
No, he's done. He's washed up. I should be more careful. I just remember we're recording this. Prime Minister Medvedev has a big, deep, long future. Now, I mean, who's to never say never, but two things I think happened to him. When he decided to step down, he disappointed a lot of those young Russians that I showed you in that slide, right? Even a lot of people in the government. His own economic advisor tweeted from the floor of that photo I showed you, politics in Russia are over. It's now time to go watch football. Arkady Dvorkovich is his name. He later, I hesitate because then later Arkady became the deputy prime minister for Putin, so he found a way to keep in government for a while. But I think he's not strong enough to support the oligarchs around Putin, and he has a complicated relationship with them. And he lost the kind of moral authority that he had with those demonstrators by not running. They wanted him to run and just lose to Putin in a free and fair election, but just to give them some choice on the ballot. And when they were denied that choice, I think, you know, he lost that generation forever.
Here's one related to kind of Putin, the existence of Putin in a way. My Ukrainian and Kazakh friends support Putin, despite his corruption, lack of democratic claiming that a country cannot move directly from communism to democracy without a strongman government during a transition. Is that what's happening in Russia? Strongman transition to democracy?
That's a great question. And it's a. It reminds me, you know, I joked about how Putin doesn't like me, and I don't know if you heard, he now wants to arrest me on some cockamamie charges that he announced in Helsinki. So he's, you know, he and I never hit it off. But there were a lot of people around him that I knew. You'd be surprised at some of the people that were close to him, very senior government officials that were also, you know, colleagues and close working partners with me. And on my way out, I had a long dinner with one of these people, and whoever asked that question, that was exactly his argument to me. He said, Mike, you know, you got to have patience with us. Putin is a progressive. He is a modernizer. Our society is conservative. And he is the transitional figure. And in fact, when we had the arguments about the Arab Spring, that was always the argument he made about Syria, by the way, and Egypt, by the way. He made it about both places. He said, we were wrong to overthrow Mubarak, in his view, and we were wrong to try to overthrow Assad because they were progressives trying to modernize their society in a very conservative society. And so that's an argument. And most certainly there are transitions around the world where that has taken place. That most certainly is true. And some people would argue that's what she's doing in China today. The social science in me says, well, actually, I know cases where they went from communism to democracy, and they did not require a dictator in between. That's Poland, that's Hungary, that's most of Eastern Europe, that's Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. They're experiencing new troubles, right? Don't get me wrong, with the rise of this autocratic nationalist nativist thing that Putin also is part of, but they didn't require one. So if I can think of cases, that doesn't mean it's a necessary condition for the transition. Number two, I can think of lots of autocratic leaders who said that's what they were doing. I'm the transition figure that then ran their country into the ground. Mugabe comes to mind. He was going to be the transitional guy, and he ruined the country. So for every autocrat that generates growth, there's several of them that repress autocratic growth, right? In the average, the autocrats grow at the same rate as the Democrats around the world the last 50 years, on average. But what screws up that data set is that there's China up here growing at, you know, 10% per year for 30 years, the democracies are here, and then the Mugabes of the world are down here. Negative growth, or Dos Santos in Angola is another one. Or even some of the Ukrainian leaders, where they just ground their country in. So it's not a necessary condition. Here's the anecdote from Russian history. There was nothing preordained about Putin becoming president. That is a myth that he wants you to believe. And it's entirely a myth. Here's what really happened. Yeltsin, remember, Yeltsin's a Democrat, twice elected, anti-Soviet guy, our ally. A lot of new memcoms have just been released. If you're interested in those 90s years of Yeltsin and Clinton's speaking, they're quite interesting. Yeltsin handpicked his own successor. His name was Boris Nemtsov. Boris was a governor in Nizhny Novgorod, twice elected out there during this economic period of the 90s that was horrible. He was re-elected governor, so he had some political skills. By the way, he was Jewish. So that means, in that society, to be elected again, he was a very talented, charismatic guy. He was actually a very close personal friend of mine, assassinated tragically in 2015, just a few steps from the Kremlin. He was the heir apparent. Everybody knew it. It was all chosen. He comes back to Moscow in December 2007, maybe February. February, I think. Doesn't matter. First deputy prime minister, Yeltsin says, this is my heir apparent. And the next year, there's a financial crash in Russia, actually around the world, wipes out the government, and Nemtsov has to resign. And in the wake of that, he picks Putin. And I think he picks Putin for one of the things we talked about earlier. I think he picks him not for any ideological reason. I think he picks Putin to protect his family's property rights. Because Putin was a tough guy, and I think they sat down and they said, all right, you get to be president as long as you don't take my daughter's wealth and my daughter's husband's wealth. And he never did, by the way. That he kept. That's how he becomes president. Picked by Yeltsin. Ratified by the people in 2000. Nobody knew who he was. It was all done by the state. So there was no groundswell of support for Putin. That's what he wants you to believe. It was done by Yeltsin. And then, just to finish the story, he just shows up at exactly the right time. 1999 is the first year that the Russian economy begins to grow. All post-communist countries go through this economic depression. They all come out of it at different times. Poland was a lot faster. Russia, 1999, they started to grow. And then, right as he becomes president, oil and gas prices shoot through the roof. And that's what generates economic growth, and that's what generates the notion that Putin has restored the Russian economy. All of that would have happened on anybody's watch. But if it happened, Americans are like this too. I don't know if you've heard of our president. He takes a lot of credit for a lot of economic growth that he had very little to do with. That's what happens with Putin. And that's how we get Putin and Putinism. And I think that there's way more contingency in that story than this inevitability that we needed this strong leader to push us forward.
Well, they've pretty much run out of time, but I wanted you to speak to one additional issue that's a major issue in the world in the news today, and that's what should our posture be towards Syria, given the Russians' involvement there?
The longest chapter in my book is about Syria, and it's long because it's a very tortured story. I think we made a lot of mistakes in the Obama administration, and I go through them. It's called Chasing Russians, Failing Syrians. That's the title of the chapter. We chased the Russians around. We had a theory that if we could just get them to agree with us, we could get a peaceful transition there. My assessment was that the Russians were never going to agree to that because of what I talked about earlier, about Putin had a different theory about how you stabilize the situation there. You need a strong man to do that. I think our best hope is stalemate. Like in Iraq, where, what happens on one side of the river, we're in charge of and our allies are in charge of, and what happens on the other side, the Russians and the Iranians are. That, I think, is our best hope, but I fear that that's not going to happen. I think there's momentum from the president to get out of there. And here again, there's two Syria policies. Maybe there's more than two, but I know of two. Where the president wants to get out, everybody else in the administration, especially over at the Pentagon, thinks that we should just hold the status quo. That's the best we can get to. I told you the abstract reason why dictators sometimes can push countries forward, but oftentimes they push them backwards. And by the way, Syria is a classic example, a horrible example of the idea that, you know, doubling down and tripling down on Assad is going to move them in a progressive way. I see no evidence to support that theory whatsoever. And I want to end on the people, the masses, the Ivan Ivanoviches, the Olgas, the Natashas that you've never met. Because I also think that their part of their history also gets written out of history. We write about these leaders, we forget about them. Remember I showed you those big demonstrations in the beginning, the people that ended the Cold War for us? You know, you all owe them some money, by the way. You should, like, write out your Cold War checks for them. Thank you, Natasha, for protesting against autocracy so that, you know, I could stop spending money on military hardware back then. We should have done that. And by the way, that's the biggest mistake I think we made. In my book, I go into it. It was in the 90s, and particularly 1992, where we should have done more to help those anonymous people that you've never met. But I've met a lot of them, and I want to end on this story. Because this inevitability thing, I think, is, you know, I give a lot of talks these days because I have this book out, and there's this notion that nothing's going to change, we're locked in. And I just want to leave you with this story from my time as ambassador. And by the way, being ambassador was awesome. I skipped that part because I was talking too long. If you ever get a chance, do it. We had a fantastic time. I focused on the negative stuff, but I love being the U.S. ambassador to Russia. It was an honor to represent this fantastic country in Russia, a country I also love. But here's the story. I showed you those demonstrations, right? And one of the things you do as ambassador is you go meet businesses, right? Your job is to meet business people and cultural people and sports people. You know, I hosted the NBA at my house in Spaso House. They haven't been to my house in Palo Alto. I hosted the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And anyway, that's one of the great things you get to do. You really get to experience society in all of its dimensions, not just New START Treaty stuff, George. Russia's a rich history, right? There's a rich culture and history and society there. So one day, I'm at a Russian company, a high-tech company, and we talked about high-tech in Silicon Valley, right? I did a lot of that because of my background. And then we got to the end, and we tiptoed through politics. And I asked them, how many had you been to that March, that May 6th demonstration in 2012 that I showed a slide of? And everybody in the room raised their hand. There's like 80 people. And you can imagine, if you've been to the Silicon Valley, it's kind of, it felt that way, beanbags, free food, you know, circa 30-ish crowd, three-quarters men, but some women there. And then there was another demonstration coming up. Can't remember what it was about. And I asked the room, well, who's going to go to that one? And only three men, young men, raised their hand. I must have given it away with my body language, you know, because I didn't say anything. But a woman in the way back, more your age than anybody else, right? Your age. She said to me, Mr. Ambassador, I think you're reading the room wrong here. I was like, what do you mean? She said, I didn't raise my hand. I'm not going to go protest. I can't afford to be arrested. I can't go to jail. I got two kids. She was an engineer. And she said, she kind of mumbled something about her no good for nothing husband. I didn't quite understand that. It was all in Russian. But, you know, I'm the breadwinner. I can't, you know, that guy, he can't take care of my kids. I'm not going to get paid if I go to jail. Because people went to jail after the May 2012 demonstration. But she said to me, she said, but don't think for a minute that I've changed my mind about Putin and this regime. And that's lingered with me, because you see these polls, he's at 80%, you know, everybody loves him. Even the bears are now afraid of him. That was the new piece that came out last night. And you know, you think about opinion polling in Russia, like, it's pretty skewed. Just remember that engineer. And I just met too many people like her to make me think that Putinism is going to last forever. I don't want to say I can predict the future, but I am actually, in the short run, pessimistic about Russia's future and the U.S.-Russia relationship. In the long run, I'm incredibly optimistic because of people like that engineer that I met. They're still part of that society, and one day I think they'll have the chance to express their preferences in a democratic society. Thank you all. Thank you.